job openings, where have a job opening for administrative director, as well as a Linux systems administrator and fall internships. Visit democracynow.org/jobs for more information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby and Becca Staley, as well as Hugh Grand, Jessica Lee, John Wallach, Vesta Gudars, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krug-Meadows, Carla De Jesus, and Phil Raymond. Again, our website is democracynow.org. You can watch, listen to, and read all of our interviews with Julian Assange, as well as on all of our shows. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
KABU wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KABU reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KABU's board of directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our board candidate package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. And we look forward to seeing more of you at KABU.
This week on Prison Pipeline.
I'm becoming less a prisoner of the state and more a prisoner of my own mind. Which is worse? That's a good question, and here's my answer. Prisons of your own making tend not to have a release date.
I'll be speaking with Anne-Marie O'Malley and her former students Akias King, Nathan McNair, and Michael Dillon. Anne-Marie teaches creative writing at the Columbia River Correctional Institution, a minimum security facility in Northeast Portland. She also works at the Independent Publishing Resource Center in Southeast Portland. And she's been publishing the works of her students in a series of books called From a Number to a Name. Learn all about this and more this week on Prison Pipeline at 6:30 p.m.
KABU Community Radio and Peña Flamenca de Portland are proud to co-sponsor Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. Pepe Rafael of Pepe and the Bottle Blondes will team up with Lily Last of Stomptown Flamenco for an evening of flamenco. Again, that's Lily Last and Pepe Rafael on Friday, July 25th at 7:30 p.m. at the Steep and Thorny Way to Heaven, located at Southeast 2nd Avenue and Madison Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor PDX Skillshare Saturday, July 12th from 1 to 6 p.m. Over 70 classes will be offered on every imaginable subject, from arts and crafts to gardening skills to advice on starting a business and more. The classes will be taught and organized by your neighbors. Learn new skills, pick up a hobby, and meet other people, all in a fun and informal setting. Again, PDX Skillshare will take place on Saturday, July 12th at George Middle School, 10,000 North Burr Avenue in St. John's. More information at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is Jim Hightower. Whenever I'm in Portland, I get my daily dose of local, national, and world news from KBOO, Portland Community Radio at its finest. And don't miss my commentaries weekdays during the KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Washington State prepares for the opening of cannabis shops across the state beginning tomorrow.
Activists in Eugene blocked the entrance to a biomass plant in a direct action today. Several activists were burned by a blowtorch when police tried to remove them.
We'll get an update from Palestine, where Israeli forces launched new airstrikes last night that killed 9 in Gaza, following a deadly week of attacks by Israeli settlers and police against Palestinian civilians.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Monday, July 7th, 2014. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. A Clackamas County man is dead after a confrontation with officers from the sheriff's SWAT team. It's still unclear whether 36-year-old Shane Griffin shot himself or was shot by officers. The SWAT team arrived at a residence near Malala at around 2 o'clock this morning after receiving a phone call of a domestic disturbance. Griffin's wife and children fled the residence when police arrived, but Shane Griffin remained inside. He had allegedly been threatening his family with multiple firearms, and someone in the house called the police. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Department said that Griffin's wife was the victim of felony domestic violence assault, but her injuries did not require medical treatment. Investigators remained on site for hours, and the agency's armored tactical vehicle remains parked nearby.
Yesterday marked the one-year anniversary of one of the worst oil train accidents in history. The crash killed 47 people in a small town in Quebec, Canada, when an oil train derailed and exploded in the middle of the town. A year later, much of the town remains so badly contaminated that there's no chance to rebuild it. Thousands of people gathered in the town of Lac Mégantic for a memorial yesterday, and across the U.S. and Canada, solidarity memorials were held to call attention to the dangers of oil trains. Here in Portland, the local branch of 350.org and other climate activists held a memorial outside the entrance to the Blues Festival at Portland's Waterfront Park. KABU's Janka Soderberg spoke with Bonnie McKinley, one of the organizers of the event.
I wonder if you could first talk about the anniversary and why you chose to hold a memorial this weekend.
Well, there's a bi-national commemoration of the Lac Mégantic disaster, U.S. and Canada people. There's about 45 actions in the U.S. where people are doing various things to bring notice to oil by rail, oil extraction in general, and, of course, this disaster from an anniversary of a year ago. The group that worked on this was primarily people from the No Keystone XL Pledge of Resistance. We're seeking activities while we wait for the State Department's decision on the Keystone XL pipeline. So we chose to become involved with this big effort, oil by rail. And it runs from July 6th through July 13th. We chose to start a little early to have it coincide with the Waterfront Blues Festival. We wanted to have a presence there. So instead of, you know, our usual tact of meeting with people, bringing out people who are sympathetic to this cause at rallies and hearings and forums, we chose to bring this issue to the public outside the gates of the Waterfront Blues Festival. So we were there all 4 days during the day and in the evenings, two of the evenings, where we held illuminated paper lanterns, we held banners, and we did a lot of leafleting while we were there.
Can you talk about the oil train disaster a year ago that killed 47 people in Canada?
Right. The disaster in Lac Mégantic was a runaway oil train. It had 72 cars on it. 63 of them collided and derailed, causing extreme explosion. A number of the victims were vaporized. It's gone down in history as one of the worst train accidents in Canada's history. And it's just been a terrible thing for the people of Quebec. While we were leafleting this weekend, I met an individual from Quebec, and he was quite struck that we were doing this. He noticed we all had T-shirts on that had headlines and front pages from the disaster of over a year ago, and he noticed that it said in remembrance of Lac-Mégantic, and he was very surprised that we here in Portland, Oregon, would be so concerned to hold a commemoration. So it was quite touching for us to be able to talk with this individual.
If people are not familiar with what is happening here locally, can you talk about what the proposals are on the table for potential coal and oil train expansion in our area?
We still are, you know, we had 6 proposals for coal export. We're down to 3. We've got the Port of Morrow project out in Boardman, Oregon. It's still viable. And we have the 2 largest coal export proposals up in Washington, Longview, and in Cherry Point. They're much bigger. Longview, 44 million tons a year of coal to be exported if that proposal goes through, and Cherry Point, 48 million. And then we have proposals up in Whatcom County, in the Ferndale Refinery, of course, the Tesoro Savage Refinery up in Vancouver, and in the existing refinery up in Anacortes. And all this combined makes a lot of extra use and wear and tear on the rail lines, increasing potential, limiting the transportation of other locally produced goods, agricultural goods, etc. So there's a wealth of reasons. I suggest that people Google Sightline Institute for extra information on that.
And how can people get involved if they are interested in taking action on this issue?
They can Google. They can go to the websites of Columbia Riverkeeper, the Beyond Coal and Oil Task Force of Southwest Washington. They're very active in opposing the Tesoro Savage terminal up there. They could always email me, and I'm happy to give my email address, which is go250pdx@gmail.com. And I can connect them with the group they may be interested in. Of course, Portland Rising Tide.
And again, that's go250pdx@gmail.com to reach Bonnie McKinley, who is a local member of the 350.org organization that tries to keep carbon emissions or bring carbon emissions to below 350 parts per million, which is what scientists say is needed in order to avert catastrophic climate change. She is joining us today to talk about the protest or memorial held this weekend outside of the Blues Festival here in Portland to commemorate the 1-year anniversary of the Lac-Mégantic oil train disaster that killed 47 people and destroyed a small town in Quebec. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Activists with Cascadia Forest Defenders and Earth First converged on the Seneca Jones biomass plant in Eugene this morning. They were protesting the company's privatization of public lands in the Elliott State Forest and ongoing pollution in West Eugene. Several protesters locked themselves to equipment at the plant, effectively blocking the truck dump where biomass is loaded into the incinerator. The plant releases an estimated 17,900 pounds of air toxins into West Eugene neighborhoods annually. There are 3 schools within 3 miles of the Seneca biomass facility. For more information, KBOO's Ken Jones spoke with Grace Warner of Cascadia Forest Defenders.
Grace, why did your group protest at the Seneca biomass plant in Eugene this morning? Well, there's a couple of reasons. The main reason that we chose to be there at this time was because Seneca Jones recently purchased a parcel in the Elliott State Forest. They privatized a couple dozen acres of land, and they're planning on clear-cutting that land after they get a hold of it.
And they're connected to the biomass plant as well.
Yeah, they own the biomass facility. And there's other companies that are looking to purchase land, to privatize land in the Elliott State Forest, which is in Coos and Douglas County, southwest Eugene. But they've been especially antagonistic in talking to the media and saying that they are buying this land so that they can clear cut it and replant it with a Douglas fir tree plantation. And we find this to be particularly heinous because they're presenting themselves as being job creators or as being people who are helping communities when actually they're taking public land out of commission, privatizing it so that nobody can go there ever again legally. And at the same time, they're in their own community in Eugene, they're polluting one of the lower income neighborhoods in our town with both their sawmill and their biomass burner.
Now, Seneca claims that the biomass plant is sustainable, and I was able to learn that they're actually getting state funds in the form of tax credits. Is that true?
Yeah, they do. They, right off the top of my head, I think they get $10 million in tax credits, so they can get up to $10 million a year. A couple of years ago, they actually asked for another $1 million on top of that. I'm not sure why, maybe because they weren't really making as big a profit as they wanted to. But it's not, I mean, it's certainly not environmentally sustainable because it's just another form of, like, commodification of our, like, soil and forest. But it's also not really economically sustainable. They're definitely taking public tax dollars and using those to pollute communities and profit off of the privatization of public forest lands.
Oh, so the biomass plant is causing pollution in the Eugene area? That's something that's been verified?
Yeah, they've actually almost immediately failed EPA air quality tests. And they've asked to have emissions standards changed for them so that they can meet them, basically. Honestly, the sawmill that's connected, their sawmill is a far bigger polluter than the biomass generator, I mean the biomass incinerator, but it's adding to the pollution that they were already emitting in this community. And there's actually three public schools within 3 miles of the biomass generator.
How many protesters were there this morning, Grace?
I'd say over 50. It's sort of hard to say because it was pretty chaotic. There's a whole bunch of people running around, like, inside the facility and supporting the people who were locked down and throwing banners. And then there was a pretty vibrant protest of people holding signs outside, a few dozen people there.
So there were more people involved than additional groups other than the Cascadia Forest Defenders?
Yeah, actually, this action followed up a week-long camp that we had in Southern Oregon called the Earth First Round River Rendezvous. And it's an annual gathering of Earth First groups and friends from all over the continent just to, like, play and protest and sing songs and do workshops. And it always culminates with an action that supports a local campaign. So this year, we brought people out and hosted them, and then people from all over the country came out and supported the rally today.
The police arrived on the scene at the biomass plant. What did the police do when they arrived?
Before the police arrived, there was actually some physical interactions. I know that one protester had their hand burned by some kind of torch that somebody was using to burn through a lock. It was sort of hairy, but they're okay. And then the police showed up in huge numbers and moved people off the property eventually within a couple hours and brought extraction equipment to cut people out of the lockdowns that they were in.
Some of the protesters were arrested?
Yeah, there's 3 people currently in custody at the Lane County Jail, and we're waiting to hear what they're being charged with.
We've been talking with Grace Warner of Cascadia Forest Defenders about a group protest at the Seneca Biomass Plant in Eugene this morning. This is Ken Jones with KBOO News.
If you'd like to read more about today's Seneca Biomass Plant protest, go to forestdefensenow.com. You can also donate to the Protesters Defense Fund on this site.
Landlords in Oregon are no longer allowed to discriminate against renters holding Section 8 vouchers. These vouchers are provided to low-income renters, usually families, when existing low-income housing units are full. Since Portland's low-income housing is almost always full and usually has a 1 to 2 year wait list, these vouchers are extremely important for people who need housing right away. But until this new ruling, landlords could openly discriminate against Section 8 voucher holders, and people found it extremely difficult to find housing. Section 8 is the largest housing program in Oregon. The new rule was pushed by Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek. The Oregonian newspaper ran a poll asking landlords if they would try to find ways to avoid accepting the vouchers, and the overwhelming majority of respondents said they would be willing to break the law to avoid accepting low-income tenants.
The first legal cannabis stores will open in Washington State tomorrow under Washington's law, Initiative 502, which legalized recreational marijuana. Many growers have not been able to get their licenses in time to produce a large yield. In turn, supply is low and prices are going to be high compared to the black market initially. An ounce of marijuana is expected to cost at least $400. Legal cannabis has not been an easy transition in Washington, as many operators have been slowed down by financing troubles, inspection questions, and other issues.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a production by KBOO's investigative team on the role of the American Legislative Exchange Council in Oregon. Tonight's piece focuses on the role of ALEC in the privatization of education in the state. This will be followed by Labor Radio, KBOO's weekly program focusing on the issues of working people, at 6 o'clock. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. On tonight's show, Amy Johnson interviews students and a teacher involved in a creative writing program at the Columbia River Correctional Institution, a minimum security facility in Northeast Portland. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with a high of 90 degrees and a 10% chance of rain. Today in history, in 1958, the Alaska Statehood Act is signed by President Dwight Eisenhower. This made Alaska the 49th state. The quote of the day is from Dr. F. William Sunderman, who said, "How infinitesimal is the importance of anything I do, but how infinitely important it is that I should do it."
It's 5:22. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
July 4th. What a blast! Cookouts, fireworks, and several 12-ounce elbow bends. Oh yeah, it's also about that thing that Thomas Jefferson penned 238 years ago. The Declaration of Independence is still a powerful read, all the more so because, ready or not, we Americans find ourselves faced with another of those when-in-the-course-of-human-events moments that old T.J. wrote about. So, having celebrated Independence Day, it's now time for we the people to redeclare our independence, this time from they the corporations. Not only are domineering corporate elites lording it over our jobs, wages, politics, Congress, the White House, most state houses, the environment, women's health, and our democratic values, but they've also captured the courts. Thus, in several 5-4 decisions in recent years, a cabal of Supreme Court corporatists, by judicial fiat, have perverted nature itself by decreeing that a corporation is a person and that its money constitutes free speech that cannot be restricted. Hello, if money is speech and more money can buy more speech, that means by definition that speech is not free. It's time to rebel. From today forward, let's treat the free in free speech as a verb, not an adjective. Let's join together and rally friends, family, co-workers, anyone, everyone, to free up our people's rights from corporate usurpers. It'll take a constitutional amendment to overrule the malicious rulings of the court's corporate clique, but we can do this. We must do it, and we're already on the move. This is Jim Hightower saying 80% of Americans support this effort. 16 states and nearly 600 cities endorse it, and 167 members of Congress are now co-sponsoring such an amendment. Hundreds of local coalitions are part of this nationwide rebellion. To join one near you, go to unitedforthepeople.org. That's United, the number four, thepeople.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Detroit is cutting off water to approximately 3,000 residential customers per week who are delinquent on their water bills. Many of the bills are less than a few hundred dollars. UN officials have condemned Detroit's actions as they believe access to water and sanitation is a basic human right. The Detroit Water and Sewage Department estimates that 50% of their accounts are past due. However, many corporate and institutional water bills are delinquent, but services for those institutions are not being shut off. Palmer Park Golf Club and the Veterans Administration Hospital are said to owe more than $200,000 each. The Detroit Red Wings hockey rink, Eastern Market, and Ford Field Stadium reportedly owe more than $55,000 each. Many believe this is an attempt to make the water department more attractive as an investment for privatization.
The U.S. Drought Monitor has issued its latest assessment and has found that huge swaths of California, Nevada, Texas, and Oklahoma are experiencing extreme or exceptional drought. The range of categories of drought had to be expanded last year to add the category exceptional. Previously, the scale only went to extreme. In June, nearly 80% of California was under extreme drought conditions. The area considered to be in the highest category of drought, exceptional, continues to grow. The Drought Monitor says that food-growing regions across the U.S. face a crisis of catastrophic proportions as historic drought continues to drive the nation's largest water reserves to record lows. Amid the shortages, private landowners are facing harsh criticism for seeking profits from this dwindling public resource. In Texas, oil tycoon T. Boone Pickens has charged local municipalities over $100 million to access water from underneath his private land. The depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer, which provides water to much of Texas, as well as to the millions of acres of farmland that make up America's breadbasket, has suffered from drought and mismanagement. Texas has laws in place that allow private landowners to charge the public for any water found on their land. Environmental groups call people like Pickens water profiteers, who are seeking to make a profit off the nation's dwindling water reserves.
6 years ago, New York State put a moratorium on the controversial practice of fracking for natural gas while the issue was being studied for impacts on health. On Monday, in a 5-2 vote, the New York Court of Appeals, New York State's highest court, backed up a lower court ruling that towns can use zoning ordinances to ban fracking and regulate land use. An energy company that had obtained oil leases prior to 2011 and a dairy that had leased their land for fracking have already filed appeals, arguing that state oil and gas laws in effect prior to the moratorium should prevail. With this ruling, additional towns in New York are considering passing zoning ordinances to ban fracking. While fracking opponents cheered, people favoring drilling accused Governor Cuomo of opposing fracking for political reasons. The director of the Community Fracking Defense Project at the Natural Resources Defense Council and the town supervisor of Dryden said they hope their victory will be an inspiration for people in other states. Oil and gas companies are promising to fight fracking, claiming jobs and profits will be lost. The general public seems to be evenly divided, meaning about half of the public will be unhappy, regardless of the outcome.
A number of people who hate President Obama and environmentalism have started a new practice that they call rolling coal. They attach special pipes to their diesel pickup trucks, which spew clouds of black smoke in protest of environmental cleanup efforts. The coal rollers, as they call themselves, object to environmentally friendly cars such as the Prius, so they adapt their diesel vehicles at the cost of thousands of dollars by using components to force more fuel into their engines. Then, when the fuel fails to combust, it's emitted as clouds of black soot. The coal rollers think this is a funny way to, quote, shoot the finger to environmentalist Obama in particular. The practice has not been regulated and has become common in states like Texas in recent months.
Unions around the country are aligning themselves with the climate movement and backing the historic People's Climate March, which is set for Sunday, September 21st, 2014 in Manhattan. The Connecticut State Council of Machinists is the latest union to join the march. Labor supporters of the march maintain that addressing the climate crisis is an opportunity to reduce unemployment, grow unions, improve community health, and restore balance to the environment. The march coincides with a September 23rd global summit on climate change called by United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
And now, we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For Doug Cunningham, I'm Joanne Powers. Truck drivers at three major California transportation companies went on strike yesterday morning at truck yards and marine terminals at the Twin Ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. The indefinite strike over unfair labor practices by the companies is an escalation following several earlier actions, which lasted only 1 or 2 days each. The workers are striking over firings, intimidation, and other retaliation against workers for engaging in legal union activities protected under the National Labor Relations Act. While $4 billion of cargo enters the nation through these ports every day to retailers such as Walmart and Home Depot, the workers struggle to make ends meet. Nick Weiner, campaign director for the Teamsters Justice for Port Drivers campaign, says the companies misclassify the workers as independent contractors, keeping them in poverty, denying them benefits, and preventing them from bargaining collectively to improve working conditions.
If it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, it looks like a duck, it's a duck. These drivers are employees of the companies that they work for. They're in no way independent. Over the past year or so, government agency after government agency has determined the drivers are right. It doesn't matter what the companies say they are. If the facts on the ground, the reality and how they're treated is an employee, then that's what they are under the law.
Advocates for workers' rights joined with a wide coalition of activists last week, including supporters of women's reproductive rights and access to health care for all, to protest at Hobby Lobby stores across the nation. The protests come on the heels of last Monday's U.S. Supreme Court decision, in which the court ruled that the religious convictions of the company's owners meant that it did not have to follow provisions of the Federal Affordable Care Act requiring employee health care plans to provide contraception coverage. At its annual representative assembly over the weekend, the nation's largest union called for the resignation of Obama administration Secretary of Education Arne Duncan. Delegates of the National Education Association passed the proposal, which cites the department's failed education agenda focused more on high-stakes testing, grading, and pitting public school students against each other based on test scores as justification for demanding the resignation. NEA's California affiliate, who introduced the business item, was also angered by comments Duncan made, seemingly in support of a recent court decision that eroded the state's tenure and seniority laws. Kim Anderson, senior director of the NEA's Center for Advocacy and Outreach.
Secretary Duncan's recent comments regarding the Vergara lawsuit in California, which relates to due process for teachers, really was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for our members. This body has considered several business items in years past that would have the NEA advocate for Secretary Duncan's removal or resignation or what have you, and this is the first time it has passed.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And now, we turn to our friends at National Native News for the latest headlines from an Indigenous perspective.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A national organization is expanding its efforts to fill teacher shortages in South Dakota. Teach for America is now serving two more reservations in the state. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
According to Teach for America, two-thirds of Native American students living on reservations don't read at their grade levels. The group's website also points out fewer than 10% of Native Americans in South Dakota have earned bachelor's degrees. Teach for America is working to help close those gaps by expanding to two reservations. The organization is active on the Rosebud and Pine Ridge reservations in southern South Dakota. Members of the Standing Rock and Lower Brule tribes are now receiving services as well. Teach for America works to fill teacher vacancies in underserved areas and to narrow an achievement gap between white and Native American students. 10 years after beginning its work in South Dakota, there are almost 80 teachers in the program, with just under 20% Native American. After providing $250,000 matched by private funds in 2012 and 2013, the South Dakota legislature did not provide funding this year. Officials with Teach for America are currently working to secure private contributions. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
An arts and cultural center planned for the Lac des Flambeaux tribe in Wisconsin is getting a financial boost. WXPR's Natalie Jablonski has more.
The USDA has awarded the project almost $90,000 towards job training for the tribe's Living Arts and Cultural Center. The center is being planned to replace the Indian Bowl, a venue in downtown Lac des Flambeaux that's currently in disrepair. Jordan Brown is chair of the project's board of directors. She says the grant will lay the groundwork for staffing once the center is built.
The $88,000 grant that was awarded to our project is a train-the-trainer grant to train the board of directors and the executive director to train us staff so we can run a successful business operation for a successful cultural center.
She says the job training grant is expected to be implemented later this year. Brown envisions the Arts Center as a hub for the region's arts and culture that could host powwows, performances, and traditional craft classes.
We're really looking forward to getting our new Indian Bowl up and running, of course getting it built first, so we can start planning our program planning, and it'll be a really nice place for people to come to visit up north as a good tourist attraction like it once was back in the heyday in the 60s.
The group is looking to hire an executive director for the project. One of the tasks ahead is raising the rest of the necessary funds. So far, the group has netted almost $800,000 toward the $3.1 million price tag. For National Native News, I'm Natalie Jablonski in Rhinelander, Wisconsin.
The annual Native American Basketball Invitational wrapped up over the weekend in Phoenix, Arizona. It's known as the largest Native American basketball tournament in the nation. This year's winners included the Rockhawks of Montana taking the girls' gold bracket, while the Rez Runners from Florida clinched the gold for boys. Andrew Bowers is head coach for the Rez Runners. He says many of the boys that played have been with him since the eighth grade.
The furthest we've ever made it in this tournament is the Elite Eight. So the guys came back. We had, you know, one motto, one game at a time until we got here. This is our goal, and it's nice to finally achieve it.
The event attracts more than 100 teams from across the U.S., Canada, and New Zealand. In Canada, the Indian Village at the Calgary Stampede opened last week. It's one of the attractions where Alberta First Nations offer visitors a glimpse of Native life with things like meat cutting, demonstrations, games, and arts and crafts. A Calgary Stampede Indian princess is also selected to serve as an ambassador. The 10-day stampede celebrates Western values and features music, rodeos, and other activities. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska.
Not voting is not rebelling, it's surrendering. Your voice counts when you vote. First, you have to register. Find out more at nativevote.org. Brought to you by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
On the U.S. Senate floor this morning, Senator Harry Reid took issue with the practice by Republican senators to block every nominee that has been brought by the Obama administration.
These are not political nominees. Most of them are career nominees. They're Republicans and Democrats. When these ambassadors are chosen, they're not chosen based on their political party. They're chosen on merit. We have places like Honduras, Qatar, Vietnam, that we don't have ambassadors there. They're even blocking Department of Defense, the Navy, the Air Force at the mercy, they're at the mercy of the Republican leaders' clock-killing obstruction. American interests abroad and the defense of our nation are forced to take a back seat while Republican leadership hopes to make political gains by running out this clock. So after having returned from the 4th of July, this country's birthday, I urge Republicans to stop this needless obstruction. What is to be gained by needlessly grinding the Senate to a halt? Only thing I can see is they think they're going to hurt Obama, who they are so upset that he got reelected and got it reelected very easily. So, Ms. President, I say to them, if you oppose a nominee, let's have a debate on the nomination and then vote. Don't delay a vote on a career Foreign Service officer that has been worked, he's worked his or her entire life to become ambassador. Don't delay national security personnel that are needed to protect our nation. Don't delay key staff people at the cabinet level from doing their work for the American people. So I don't expect Republicans to give their unanimous consent to every nominee on the calendar. Rather, Senate Democrats are asking that Republicans legislate in good faith. Let's look at these. If there is something wrong with them, let's debate them. If nominees are deserving of their unanimous support, and most of them come out of the committees unanimously, why waste the Senate's time by blocking confirmation of these individuals? There's no reason for doing that. We have so much to address over the coming weeks, Mr. President. We're going to vote on the sportsman's bill tonight, but the highway bill, emergency supplemental, manufacturing legislation. We're going to do something about the Hobby Lobby legislation we need to correct. There is so much that we have to do. We have terrorism insurance. We have to do that. Export-import bank. We've got to do that. But we are being stopped from doing all of that, Mr. President. We have more than enough to keep us busy. That's an understatement. And so what we're doing, instead of doing the thing that is necessary for the American people, we're just being forced because of the obstructions of Republicans to sit here and struggle through a few nominations that we can work out by spending 8 hours on this one, 4 hours on that one, 30 hours on this one. It's really unfair to the American people.
That was Senator Harry Reid speaking this morning in the U.S. Senate.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, July 7th, 2014. Nine Palestinians are killed in Gaza due to Israeli bombardment. Meanwhile, army invasions targeting West Bank communities leave scores injured. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. At least nine Palestinians have been killed by Israeli missiles and shells in the Gaza Strip on Sunday and Monday at dawn, Palestinian medical sources announced. Al-Qassam brigades of the Hamas movement stated that six fighters have been killed when the Israeli army fired missiles into a siege-busting tunnel in Rafah in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Their bodies were found on Monday at dawn. Another Qassam fighter died on Monday of wounds he suffered during an earlier shelling in Rafah. Sami Abu Zuhri, spokesperson of the Hamas movement, stated that the assassination of the fighters is a serious escalation, adding that the enemy will pay a heavy price. Five more Palestinians, including a child and two young girls, have been injured when an Israeli missile detonated near their home in Beit Hanun in northern Gaza. Another airstrike targeted Al-Qarara town east of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Missiles have also been fired into agricultural lands in Sheikh Radwan in Gaza, causing damage but no injuries. On Sunday, two fighters have been killed by Israeli missile in Al-Burej refugee camp. Their bodies have been severely mutilated. From their parts, Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza claimed responsibility for the firing of dozens of shells into adjacent Israeli areas in retaliation to the Israeli military escalation. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded on Monday at dawn several Palestinian communities in the occupied West Bank, clashed with local youth, causing dozens of injuries, while several Palestinians have been kidnapped by Israeli troops. Medical sources in the southern West Bank city of Hebron have reported that at least 20 Palestinians have been shot with rubber-coated steel bullets in Al-Arub refugee camp. Two more Palestinians suffered various cuts and bruises after being assaulted by Israeli soldiers who invaded and ransacked several homes in the camp. In Tul Karim, in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, two Palestinians were shot with live rounds and dozens suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. In addition, two Palestinians were shot with rubber-coated steel bullets, while dozens suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation during clashes that took place with dozens of soldiers who invaded Jericho City from the northern entrance. Moreover, the Israeli police kidnapped overnight on Monday 110 Palestinians, around half of them are children, during protests that swept across Arab towns in Israel. Massive protests were held in different parts of the country, while protests also closed various roads, including Tamra Acker Road, and clashed with Israeli police officers who assaulted them. The police continued to resort to excessive use of force in an attempt to end the protests. People are protesting the kidnapping and brutal murder of Mohammed Abu Khdeir in Jerusalem last week. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, July 7th, 2014 News Roundup from the Occupied Palestinian Territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Blake Federson, Ken Jones, and Rosalind Scott. Special thanks to Maya Melton and Michael Gaskell. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, our phone lines are open for your calls on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, Alternative Radio features Paul Cienfuegos, a regional leader in the community rights movement, which works to dismantle corporate constitutional so-called rights and assert the people's inherent right to self-government. He's helping to establish the Oregon Community Rights Network, which launched in 2013 and is based in Portland, Oregon. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on stage and studio, Dee Mae Roberts welcomes Terry Mathern, Artistic Director of Conduit Dance in downtown Portland. She'll tell us about the Dance Plus Summer Festival of curated multidiscipline dance with veteran and emerging performers. And at 11:30 on Art Focused, host Ava Lake interviews Elise Wagner, who currently has a show at Butter's Gallery. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now stay tuned for the latest production by KBOO's investigative team on the role of the American Legislative Exchange Council in Oregon. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. And good night, Danielle.
The Governor Jeb Bush delivering an education reform address to the American Legislative Exchange Council at their annual meeting in Chicago last year.
What Alec was talking about 20 years ago has sadly come to pass. In most places, we have an education system designed around the economic interests of the adults, where academic achievement of the kids is secondary.
The American Legislative Exchange Council, a free market, limited government, nonprofit, has for many years been geared toward removing regulations in the interest of businesses, commerce, and profits. 20 years ago, the organization made the privatization of schools a top priority.
Through its education task force, ALEC has flooded state legislatures with no less than 66 pieces of school reform legislation since the early 1990s. Their collective purpose? To attack the public school system through voucher programs, charter school expansion, and tax credits to corporations that fund charter schools. So says Julie Underwood, Dean of the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin.
The ALEC archive, as it relates to education, shows a broad array of bills, but what you see is an early indication or an early interest in privatization of education. There are lots and lots of bills that talk about various ways to privatize or defund, dismantle the public schools. You have bills that are about charter schools, vouchers, tuition tax credits, deductions, those kind of things that actually all put together really are just a push to privatize education.
27 model bills from ALEC's 9 task forces made their way to the Oregon legislature just in 2011. That year was a bumper crop for ALEC. 7 of those were education-related bills, and by 2013, 2 more had been introduced. All of them came from the Oregon House and Senate Interim Committees on Education. And that bums rush was part of ALEC's strategy, according to Ms. Underwood.
They do have an interesting legislative strategy there. They keep giving advice to people in the states, and they say that, you know, in these 4 areas, you need to introduce a lot of bills, and you need to introduce the entire array of them all at the same time. So they analogize this to a game of whack-a-mole, so where you actually can introduce all sorts of bills, and they say that if you do that, then the education proponents won't be able to kill them all at one time, just like a game of whack-a-mole.
That House Interim Committee on Education was heavy with ALEC members, including Jason Conger, John Huffman, and Matt Wingard. And the bills their committee sponsored span the gamut for privatization of public education, whether through delegitimizing public schools with an arbitrary quality grading system, allowing children to attend a charter school outside of their resident district, online and virtual education options, or restricting public school districts in how and when they may evaluate charter schools.
Matt Wingard, former member of Oregon Legislature, delivering 2011 weekly address on the charter school bills introduced during the session.
So some of the things that are in legislation that we're bringing this session is a bill for full funding of charter schools, a bill to allow for multiple authorizers of charter schools so that, say, for instance, community colleges could start charter schools. There are a number of community colleges that have expressed interest in being able to do that. We also have a bill to create real clear A through F grading of our public school buildings so that you as a parent or a citizen would understand very clearly how your local public school is performing. As House Republicans, our bills are designed to increase standards in our public education system and, as I said, to increase choices for parents.
And although the titles sound very positive and the descriptions promise better accountability for the public schools while more choices for parents, the intent of all of these pieces of model legislation was privatize public education by providing tax credits to corporations funding charter schools, remove restrictions for charter school operation, and remove state authority to oversee charter schools. In Oregon, there are two education-focused companies that have had ALEC affiliation, the Connections Academy and K-12 Incorporated. Both of these companies have pushed a national agenda to replace bricks-and-mortar classrooms with computers and replace actual teachers with virtual teachers. In 2003, K-12 national organization took in $848 million from its businesses, with $731 million coming from its public management schools. And since many of those publicly managed schools are funded directly from taxpayer dollars, its revenue source is almost completely taxpayer-based. But K-12 has its critics, most notably on Wall Street. Last year, hedge fund manager Whitney Tilson said he was shorting K-12 stock in a bet that this company would fail. He said that although the idea of virtual education had strong support from the right, K-12 has posted poor academic results with dropout rates as high as 50%. K-12 operates four network schools in Oregon, the Oregon Virtual Academy in North Bend, the Inside School of Oregon in Prineville in Portland, and the Oregon iSchool in Lebanon.
The story with the Connections Academy is equally interesting. A spokesperson for Connection Academy, based in Baltimore, Maryland, told the Center for Media and Democracy in July 2012 that it had cut ties with ALEC to, quote, align our affiliations with organizations whose central focus is education. However, it's possible that the real reason it left was the reason many other companies left ALEC that year, because of negative publicity over ALEC's promotion of the Castle Amendment, otherwise known as Stand Your Ground gun laws. Connections Academy has also donated to the campaigns of several current and former legislators, including Oregon ALEC member Sherry Springer, who represents SCIO, where the Oregon branch of Connection Academy, or ORCA, is headquartered, as well as Matt Wingard. Springer co-sponsored many of Wingard's charter school bills.
During his time in office, Wingard was an ardent supporter of privatization. He became a rising star in the state Republican Party when he was elected in 2008. A former television journalist, Wingard represented District 26, which includes Sherwood and Wilsonville. His connection to ALEC has been known ever since Representative Gene Wisnant included his name on the list of current and former ALEC legislators that he gave to Oregonian in 2013. The website ALEC Exposed has also revealed that Wingard was on ALEC Education Task Force, and according to the Oregon Secretary of State, Wingard attended ALEC conferences in 2010 and 2011. However, his political career was derailed by scandal, which ultimately led to him resigning his office in 2012.
Wingard's connection to the school's national parent did not go unremarked. Some saw it as a clear conflict of interest. Wingard was named the chair of the House Education Committee in 2011, and he was a member of the ALEC Education Task Force. In 2011, Wingard either directly sponsored or brought forward by committee all but one of the ALEC-inspired charter school bills. Curiously, many of Wingard's charter school bills were lifted verbatim from ALEC model bill language, but that connection was never openly admitted.
Connections Academy has donated to the Foundation for Excellence in Education, a national nonprofit founded by former Florida Governor Jeb Bush in 2008. In 2011, public records requests showed interactions between the Foundation and Chiefs of For Change, another Bush-backed group which brought together state education leaders, as well as sitting state education officials. Chiefs for Change, much like ALEC, paired education officials with corporations profiting from privatized education and provided them with policies originally written by ALEC. Both ALEC and the Foundation for Excellence in Education share staff or members, and the two organizations often collaborate. With both K-12 and the Connections Academy, there's ongoing criticism over the idea of putting children as young as five in front of a computer screen rather than in a classroom with other students. Stephanie Soule, in 2011 New York Times piece, pointed out that low-paid teachers for such schools can have as many as 250 students at the time, but very poor interactions with them and their parents. Jeff Kropp is the president of Oregon Connections Academy and the state chair of Oregon's chapter of Americans for Prosperity, the Koch brothers-funded conservative nonprofit.
We think that socialization is an important piece of the puzzle. And the way it's supposed to work is that let's say you want to participate in athletics like I did, football, basketball, baseball, track, whatever, that even though a child comes to Orca, and let's say they're from Salem Kaiser, they're supposed to be able to go back to that Salem Kaiser school and participate in athletics and do those kinds of things. Now, it doesn't always happen that way, and that's unfortunate, but you know, we work very hard at trying to make sure there's lots of opportunities for socialization so that, you know, people can, you know, the public high school experience for some of these students is really as good as we can possibly make it, given that it's a virtual online charter school.
One of the issues around charter schools is funding, with opponents accusing charter schools of getting equal funding per child without the overhead of public schools. This unobstructed flow of cash, some say, gives charters a license to be financially irresponsible, with nearly 150 of the 300 new charter schools that start each year failing. Jeff Kropf of Orca defends charters, but admits there are problems.
You know, charter schools don't have a quote-unquote tax base. They do get funding, obviously, because we're a public school. We get funding, but only through the legislature. So the Scioto School District that charters us has a property tax funding base, and they get funding both from the federal level and from the state level. So, in fact, we don't even get the same amount of money that the Scioto School District does for their students. We actually get, I think we're at 85% of what a regular bricks and mortar school gets. So in some cases, at least in Oregon, I think that, you know, bad management is part of it, and there's no, and this is one of the reasons why we have a professional management company that manages online charter schools, and yes, they are a for-profit company out of Baltimore called Connections Academy, and they, you know, they're professionals at this and very highly qualified. Everybody in their company